Good morning. It's Monday, June 30th. I'm Shumita Basu. This is Apple News Today. On today's show, the fallout from the Supreme Court's ruling on birthright citizenship. Florida gets to work on a detention center dubbed Alligator Alcatraz. And Beyonce was left dangling mid-air during a stadium show when her flying car malfunctioned. But first, the latest on the Republican tax and spending bill. The Senate narrowly voted to advance it on Saturday night by 51 to 49 votes. That led to Senate Democrats insisting on reading the entirety of the 940-page bill on the Senate floor, a marathon effort that spanned through the night and into Sunday afternoon before giving way to debate. All this comes as there's still significant discord over the bill's proposals, even among some Republicans. Over the weekend, the Independent Congressional Budget Office estimated the bill will add $3.3 trillion to the national debt over the next decade. Only two Republican senators voted against the bill: Rand Paul of Kentucky, who said he was concerned about the national debt, and Tom Tillis of North Carolina, who cited concerns over the loss of funding for his constituents. After Trump made it clear that he would back a primary challenger to push Tillis out, Tillis announced his decision to not seek re-election, saying that independent thinkers were becoming an endangered species. During debate on the Senate floor on Sunday night, Tillis attacked planned cuts to money states get to fund Medicaid and said the president was breaking his promise on Medicaid.
But I'm telling the president that you have been misinformed. You supporting the Senate mark will hurt people who are eligible and qualified for Medicaid.
Republicans want to create work requirements for Medicaid, a measure Tillis actually supports, arguing that it would stop abuse of the program and ensure that it would be available for those that truly need it. Jean Whalen is an economics reporter with The Wall Street Journal. She told us about how the work requirements that passed in the House version of the bill are structured.
Most childless adults without disabilities between the ages of 19 and 64 would need to spend 80 hours a month either working or engaging in job training or community service in order to qualify for Medicaid and in order to keep their Medicaid if they already have it. There would be some exceptions for parents of minor children, for people with substance use disorders, and a few other groups would be exempt.
The Senate version has included a similar proposal. While lawmakers in Washington debate this point, Whalen has been looking at states that have already taken this approach and what lessons we can learn from them. In Arkansas, there was a short-lived program that began in 2018 that introduced work requirements. It was halted by a judge the following year.
Before it was scrapped, there was a lot of evidence that many, many people were losing their Medicaid, and the employment rates within the intended group didn't really change much. We didn't see a big leap in employment in that population. That's according to a Harvard economist, Ben Summers, who studied the program there in Arkansas and found that many of the people in the intended population were already working or meeting the requirements in some other way.
There were also major technical and bureaucratic problems with the plan. For example, residents had a difficult time reporting their work status on the state websites.
Believe it or not, the website wouldn't accept submissions after a certain time of night, like the website shut down, which I didn't realize is a thing websites could do, but that is what happened.
Another pilot program that began in Georgia in 2023 is having similar issues with the challenge of monthly reporting requirements.
The enrollment has been pretty dismal compared with what the state was projecting. So they projected 25,000 people would enroll in the first year, and they had, as of the two-year mark, only about 8,000 people enrolled. So it's been far short of even the state's expectations.
The Republican governors of Arkansas and Georgia stand behind the idea of creating work requirements for Medicaid. But the Journal reports that both states are in the process of easing those requirements due to low enrollment and problems with the program. And on the national level, the data shows that many people who can work do. According to a national analysis done by the health policy research organization KFF, 44% of Medicaid recipients under the age of 65 were working full-time in 2023, and about 20% were working part-time. The Congressional Budget Office has estimated that the work requirements imposed in the House bill would apply to over 18 million low-income adults, with more than 5 million likely to lose coverage in the next decade. And on Saturday, the CBO said that the overall Medicaid changes in the Senate bill would lead to even deeper cuts and more Americans becoming uninsured than the House version. Legal experts and advocates are still sorting through how Friday's major Supreme Court ruling on birthright citizenship could impact the future of citizenship in this country. The 6-3 ruling in favor of the Trump administration's position did not directly rule on the constitutionality of his executive order seeking to end a right that has been part of the Constitution for more than 150 years. Rather, the court issued a ruling that limited the ability of federal judges to issue nationwide injunctions, which have been used to block executive actions in the past. The Supreme Court ruling will not take effect for 30 days, but the legal landscape ahead is uncertain.
There are a lot of moving pieces and variables that could affect the way that this all unfolds.
That's Ankush Koduri, legal affairs columnist for Politico and a former federal prosecutor.
I think actually this week we could see sort of a flurry of moves on the part of both the plaintiffs and the government as they sort of try to reckon with this ruling.
Now, the Supreme Court did provide a carve-out of sorts for different legal challenges via class action suits. And in the hours after the ruling, a number of civil rights groups did exactly that, reconfiguring their cases around the new legal outlook. Individual states like New Jersey are also saying that lawyers representing them are likely to continue to push for a nationwide reprieve from the executive order. Koduri explained some of the logic there.
They've said that they cannot proceed simply on an injunction that applies within their state. They need a nationwide injunction because people move in and out of states all the time. And because of the implications for the order on the state government's mechanisms, a localized state-specific injunction will not provide them with the complete relief that they require.
If additional litigation doesn't change the current legal landscape in the next 30 days, Trump's executive order could take effect in the 28 states that have not directly challenged it, meaning that, practically speaking, children born in different parts of the country might be denied a constitutional right that others would have.
You can have a situation in place where the order only applies to certain states and not to residents of other states. And that would be a very messy situation. Now, we've seen this in other contexts already, right, with the overruling of Roe. We have a patchwork of abortion rights now in this country.
On Friday, President Trump and his attorney general, Pam Bondi, celebrated the Supreme Court ruling as a victory, but largely dodged questions about how such an executive order would be enforced. As part of a nationwide class action lawsuit filed on Friday, the ACLU is seeking to create a protected class of children who could be impacted by the order at birth. And now on to Florida, which is racing ahead with building a new immigration detention center on an airstrip tucked deep into the Everglades, dubbed by officials Alligator Alcatraz. It's been reported that the 1,000-bed facility will open within days on environmentally sensitive land owned by Miami-Dade County. Trucks with portable restrooms and industrial generators began arriving last week to start work on the facility. Over the weekend, protesters assembled on a highway that runs through the Everglades as dump trucks with materials passed through. Daniel Mlodozenich explained to the AP why he was there.
It's not good for the water. It's not good for the wildlife and the habitats. Why is it here? It totally undermines and undoes a lot of the brilliant restoration work that's been going on and has been so heavily funded through the years. And it shouldn't be here.
But Governor Ron DeSantis is determined to make it happen and has fast-tracked the project under an Emergency Powers Act. Here's Miami Herald reporter Ana Ceballos, who covers politics and immigration.
There's wildlife all around. There's a lot of alligators, a lot of pythons, mosquitoes that are, you know, maybe not the size of fists, but they're pretty large.
The harsh optics of a detention facility surrounded by hostile elements is meant to send a message to migrants who are in the country illegally. You can choose to self-deport or else be sent to a facility like this.
When you feel the hostility in the environment and just the conditions that detainees would be held in, it's also the middle of summer in Florida. It's hot. It's not a pleasant environment to be in.
DeSantis has been outspoken about wanting Florida to play a bigger role in the Trump administration's aggressive deportation policy. He and other Florida lawmakers have been lobbying the federal government to give them the authority to detain, house, and deport immigrants.
He has tried to do really everything he can to make the Trump agenda a functional agenda in the state. He has pushed local and state police to participate in a federal immigration program known as 287G, for example, that pretty much deputizes local officers to be able to perform some of the duties of federal immigration agents.
Ceballos reported that Florida will run the facility at a cost of around $450 million annually, though the state will be able to seek reimbursement from the federal government, according to the Department of Homeland Security.
We are seeing a more proactive collaboration, if you will, and DeSantis not only having a role with the enforcement on the ground, but also the detention and possibly the deportation of these individuals, because the facility in the Everglades does have a functioning runway. What we know is that DeSantis and state officials have expressed an interest in doing that.
While the runway is mostly used for training and practice flights, the state attorney general has claimed that it could accommodate large planes. Starting this week, the Florida National Guard is expected to deploy around 100 soldiers to secure the site. Before we let you go, a few other stories we're following. Two firefighters in Idaho were killed, and another is fighting for his life after being ambushed by gunfire while responding to a blaze in the mountainous city of Coeur d'Alene, which authorities say they do not believe started on its own. Here's Kootenai County Sheriff Robert Norris speaking with reporters last night.
Based on the information that we've been able to collect, we believe that there was only one shooter. We do believe that the suspect started the fire, and we do believe that it was an ambush and it was intentional. These firefighters did not have a chance.
Over 300 law enforcement officers rushed to the scene, and a gunfight lasted several hours. Eventually, with the help of federal agents, responders pinpointed a mobile phone signal to find the dead body of a man with a firearm nearby. Governor Brad Little said he was heartbroken by the news and described the attack as a heinous assault. Because of the protracted gunfight, firefighters were delayed in tackling the fire itself, which had burned over 20 acres of land on Sunday night. As of this morning, authorities have not released information about the victims or the suspect. In international news, the head of the UN's nuclear watchdog said that Iran could begin enriching uranium within months following American strikes on the country. This contradicts President Trump's claims that Iran's nuclear sites had been, quote, completely destroyed. In an interview on CBS, the head of the UN watchdog group, Rafael Grossi, said that at some point they would have to return to Iran to inspect more.
I think we can speculate until, of course, the Iranians themselves will have to go there and sift through the, you know, rubble and look at what is the exact degree of the damage. At some point, the IAEA will have to return, although our job is not to assess damage, but to reestablish the knowledge of the activities that take place there.
His comments appear to align more with an early assessment from within the Pentagon, reported in CNN and other outlets, that the strikes did not fully wipe out Iran's nuclear capabilities. And finally, Beyoncé may deliver a stadium show like no other, but she was forced to hit the brakes mid-show in her home state of Texas as the flying car she entered on began to tilt. Beyoncé was singing her song 16 Carriages on top of a red Cadillac prop hoisted high above her fans, but as you'll hear in a video captured by concertgoers, she cut the song short after detecting that something was wrong.
Stop.
She was slowly lowered to the ground and, like a pro, went on with the show.
I want to thank y'all for loving me. Whenever I fall, I know y'all catch me.
You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening in the News app right now, stick around for the latest episode of Apple News in Conversation. I speak with journalist Megan Greenwell about how private equity has crept into seemingly every corner of American life, from taking over retail chains to hospitals, even housing.
Private equity guys sell themselves as these sort of swashbuckling heroes who are willing to take the risks nobody else will take to save these companies. It's almost like a heroic thing, even though they are also making gazillions of dollars off of it. And the truth of the matter is, the more you read, the more you realize there's no risk for them at all.
If you're listening in the podcast app, follow Apple News in Conversation to find that episode. And I'll be back with the news tomorrow.